I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Catalpa Escape podcast series. Margot O'Byrne, welcome back, Margot.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back.
Can you believe we're at episode 8 of this thrilling story, Margot?
It's more intriguing all the time, really, isn't it, Michael?
Well, we're pausing and going slowly now because we want our listeners to be turning up the volume, asking themselves, what's coming today? Well, let me assure you, listeners, there's a lot coming today. We left you with John Breslin posing as Mr. Collins, having arrived in Fremantle and endearing himself to the colonial authorities and the business community, acting as a man of considerable means, looking around here and there, having met Mary Tomtit, it seems, when he was staying at the hotel, and also through an ex-military Fenian go-between, Will Foley, having met the Fenian prisoners that he wants to whisk out of the country. But of course, he's sauntering up and down, hoping that the good ship Catalpa will arrive one day soon, so they can put all their plans into action. So let's just sort of go back. January 1876, this January, that'll be 150 years ago. And everyone, I suppose, is really on edge, thinking the rescue is imminent. Do we know anything different?
He was expecting that the Catalpa would arrive in late January. That was the plan when he left the US and when the Catalpa left the US back in April of 1875. And Breslin, of course, left in August. So long time, long time in planning. So, okay, January was going to be the month. So in that time, he decided that it was too dangerous for Will Foley to remain here, and he'd purchased him a ticket out of the colony because remember that, as you said, Will was a go-between. And he felt that if he was left here, he'd be arrested after the rescue and interrogated and thrown into prison.
Foley would have been the obvious
Foley,
person
correct.
when they sat down and thought about it, who'd been playing that role.
He would have been,
So is that what happened? Did Foley head off out?
He did head off out, and he will appear later on in the story, Michael, but I'm not telling you where.
Listeners, you're going to have to. We're going to draw this right out, mind you. It doesn't need drawing out. It just draws itself out. So we've got Breslin, you have to imagine him, down on High Street here. He's staying at the Emerald Isle Hotel. I think you've told us before he wasn't too far from the telegraph office. He could go down to now the site of the Buffalo Club and have a look on the notice board to see what ships are coming and going, particularly down in Bunbury. But no news of the Catalpa, I gather, Margot.
None at all, none at all. Each day, you can imagine him there looking each day, looking, looking, and no news of Catalpa. So he started to sense that maybe the people in Fremantle were beginning to ask questions about why a man who would come here to invest in the whole of WA was spending so much time in their town. And so to stave off these questions, he arranged to take a horse and trap and set out on a business trip to the interior. And before he headed out of Fremantle, he had just one more meeting with Wilson. Now, we don't know how that was arranged because remember Foley had already gone. But he said to, and Wilson told him at that stage that some of the Fenians were starting to get a bit restless. Well, I'm sure Breslin was getting restless too. And so Breslin reminded Wilson to tell the fellows that, they were good Fenian soldiers. That, the rescue was at hand, but they had to be on their best behaviour, keep their heads low, make sure that they didn't get into any trouble that would throw them into solitary confinement, and that they needed to be working in those working parties outside of the jail because that was the only way he could get them out.
I love this idea of the interior. Just where did Breslin Collins, as he was known around the place, where did he go?
Oh, well, it was a long way in those days, Michael. So he went to places like Perth and Guildford and York and Northam and 2J, which of course was then known as Newcastle. And And that's, of course, was the agricultural area of the colony at that time, wasn't it? And he talked to anyone and everyone that he could about business opportunities and investments, and he clearly had the gift of the gab, this man.
Well, as you say, he must all the time, each morning he got up, be still hoping that the catalpa would be arriving or just about to arrive. And when he completed this, this act of being a wealthy businessman looking for opportunities, he'd get back to Fremantle and find that everything was happening. But I said last time when they make the movie, we've got the love interest in all of this. Mary Tondet, what's happening with the two of them?
Okay, well, we remember, listeners will remember that Mary was the chambermaid at the Emerald Isle Hotel, and their friendship has clearly blossomed. In fact, they've fallen in love, so much so that Breslin had was obviously proposing to her and said that, trying to make arrangements with Patrick Maloney. So we learn that Patrick Maloney is probably a lot more involved in this. He's the proprietor of the Emerald Isle. And he was trying to make arrangements through Patrick Maloney to bring her to America after he had left. But he was tormented by what he saw as his moral failure for becoming her lover. And he realised that his indiscretion could perhaps even jeopardise the rescue. And we
Well,
don't.
yeah, I mean, what you wonder, don't you? I mean, a lot of pillow chatter. Did he tell her who he really was? Have we got any clues as to whether he did or didn't?
Well, there's always a lot of speculation around that, but I think the proof that she knew a lot more than she let on is that, of course, she informed him in March of 1876 that she was pregnant with his child. And we know that that son, it was a son that they had, and that he was born later that year in Sydney, and that he was christened by Breslin's name, John Joseph, but Tondet, and that his father was on the register of this child's birth. The name of the father was listed as John Joseph Breslin.
Which is actually Breslin's name, his real
Correct.
name.
Correct.
So she knew that, and whatever else she knew, we don't really have to speculate, do we?
No.
He was on side. Maloney here, he may have known a certain amount. He knew he was an American, probably going back there and wanted to take his wife to be, if that's what was going to happen. Oh golly! So that's not till March that Collins Breslin is told this by Mary. But
Correct.
at that point, they're still waiting on the damn ship.
They are indeed. So it, on as Breslin, he took this trip into the interior, and then he also took a trip. Of course, he's still looking for the escape site. He doesn't know where on earth he's going to get these Fenians onto the catalpa when it does eventually arrive. So he takes a trip on to the isolated settlement of Rockingham. In those days, Rockingham was pretty much just, it had a hotel and it also had a sawmill. So the logs came down from Jarrodale and they were sawn there in a sawmill on Rockingham foreshore, and then obviously loaded onto barges or ships or whatever. And there was a road along then that was known as the Fenian Road, because it was basically built by the Fenians, and that was a bit of a compact pathway to get people out of Fremantle and towards Rockingham. But then it sort of petered out into a sandy track that just kind of wound its way through coastal heathland until it got to the wooden-framed Rockingham Hotel. So Breslin scouted that whole area, and he was delighted when he found the place that he felt that he and Desmond could drive the traps pretty much right onto the beach. And listeners from our area of the world will know that Cockburn Sound is quite calm, and the beach, the road and the beach are very close together, as opposed to the long lots of beaches that we have here, where you travel a long way from the road down to the foreshore.
How far is this magical spot from Freo?
Well, he calculated at the time that it was 20 miles.
Right.
and that it would take him 2 hours and 20 minutes to drive the horse and trap down there.
And the fans.
Yeah, so he
Wow.
felt that this would be the place.
And as it happens, I think we can divulge it became the place.
It became the place. It did indeed. And he
And do we
said that if.
know exactly where that place is today? Can we go there?
Well, we certainly can. And there's it's known by those of us who love the story as the escape site. And of course, there's a beautiful sculpture there by Charlie Smith and Joan Walsh Smith that is of the six wild geese flying out to freedom. And of course, the Irish Heritage Association each year has a commemoration down there to
Well,
celebrate, spoiler alert, but to celebrate the escape.
yes. Well, it means that Cranston, Darra, Hassett, Harrington, Hogan, and Wilson, the six wild geese, had somewhere to go. They had a catalpa waiting. If they were doing this today, they'd be getting on a nuclear-powered submarine from the naval base near Rockingham to get out of the country, I suppose, Margot.
Or an AUKUS submarine soon to arrive, Michael.
Something like that. But we jump ahead of ourselves because this ship Catalpa hasn't quite got here. What's going on at sea? Do we have any idea?
Well, it was still as Breslin's looking out at the Indian Ocean. Of course, the Catalpa is on the Indian Ocean, and it's heading towards Australia. But it was becalmed for a long time. And remember, listeners to previous episodes will remember, of course, that it met up south of South Africa. It met up with the Ocean Beauty, and Captain Anthony had a gam with Captain Cousins of the Ocean Beauty, and from Cousins he obtained charts of the West Australian coast because Cousins, our friend Cousins, had been the captain of the Hougoumont when it brought these very same Fenians to Western Australia.
It's just such an amazing part of the story that, as we remarked at the time you were telling it. So, no news here. We're all waiting, pacing up and down High Street, going down to Rockingham, such as it was. The hotel was there, wooden structured, worked out where he was going to have the historical escape point. But they must have all been getting pretty testy. Does anybody try to send a message to anybody to find out WTF, where are they?
Well, Breslin is very, I mean, how this man remained calm through all of this is truly, a lesson for all of us. But as March approached, he wrote to Judge Cooney in California, and he's expressed his fears about the Catalpa's fate. He said, and Cooney forwarded that letter to Devoy, and when the Irishman read it, well, his mind turned to darker thoughts. He was worried about the whaler's tardiness. He was worried about whether Hathaway and Richardson had given him the right man in Captain Anthony. And maybe Anthony had abandoned the mission, I mean, there's no way of telling.
All these thoughts would go through your mind for sure. So have they done the dirty on us? Have they finished up in Davy Jones's locker? Have pirates knocked them off? Have the crew mutinied? Have they run into something? Perhaps a whale, Moby Dick. But so what happens?
So, but of course, Devoy was reassured when he realised how reliable Duggan was, and he was the
Oh, this
carpenter.
was the Irish plant on the ship.
Correct. And remember, Duggan had been a friend of Devoy since childhood, so he totally trusted him. If anything was happening, Duggan would have kept Captain Anthony in line. Not that Captain Anthony needed it at all, but so that. Probably Devoy was just reassuring his own mind about that. But the other problem for Breslin, Michael, was that his funds were running out.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned Cooney, you mentioned the Californians, you mentioned the people in New Zealand and Australian goldfields in the east. Certain amount of money had been given to him, but he had to flash it around in Breslin Collins here, looking
Yeah.
like he was the man of inexhaustible means. Must have been getting a bit low, Margot.
It was. So finally he telegraphed Cooney in California and said that it seems that the rescue committee, with our good old friend John Gough, The bean counter, the lawyer bean counter,
back in New York.
back in New York, questioning every cent that was allocated to the mission. And Breslin's, saying, could the Californian investors please send some more? But DeVoy, of course, was furious when he found this out.
Well, you would be, wouldn't you? I mean, you've got a man there. They're risking their lives and so on and so forth. But do they come to their senses?
Well, we don't know actually. We don't know if that committee did send him any more money, but it doesn't seem that if it came, it didn't come quickly. So Breslin, now that he'd found the suitable exit point, ready to go, he was finding increasing solace in the arms of Mary. And now that she was pregnant, he was tormented even more by his indiscretion. But he still had to keep up his business, this whole business of what he was doing. So he, in March, early March, he saw a notice on the telegraph office that there was a ship out of New Bedford called the Canton, that had docked in Bunbury. So he sent a message, wired a message down there to the captain and said if had he heard or seen anything of the Catalpa. And the captain's reply came back in true captain style, no news.
Oh, golly. You get a little bit more panicky at that point. So,
Yes.
what did Breslin do?
Well, he decided he'd go to Bunbury himself. So he purchased a ticket on the mail coach, which was a dusty 120-mile trip in those days. And even though his cash was dwindling, he kept up the appearances and, of course, took a first-class seat.
Well, the word would get out pretty quick if you were going steerage, wouldn't it? That you didn't have the money you were pretending you had.
That's right. That's right. And so he said that he wanted to investigate the land between Perth and the Bass and see what its productivity was like, whether it was worth investing in, I mean, he must have had the gift of the gab, this man, for sure.
Totally, and as charming as they come.
Yeah.
Well, ask Mary.
But on the day that he left for Bunbury, the Georgette turns up in Fremantle, and who should be on the Georgette but our man John King?
Ah, now I've forgotten about King. He'd come across, having met these guys in Sydney, found his way to King George Sound, Albany, as we call it today. Beautiful
Correct.
place. Been waiting to get out of the place and get on a ship and come up, and had to conspire to do that because they were holding them. So he got on the ship, he got on the Georgette, which plied the coastal trade, and what? He's on the Georgette coming into Frio.
Coming into Frio, remember with his Gladstone bag, he had a very heavy Gladstone bag that he had to throw in the bush when the quarantine officers came to take it away and spray it. And of course, this contained a lot of money and gold for Breslin's use, which King had collected in the eastern states of Australia and in New Zealand. He didn't know that Mr. Collins was away, but he walked down to the Emerald Isle Hotel and asked to see him. And he was told that Mr. Collins had left for a few days. So he checked into the hotel as, and his aliases are fairly suspect, George Jones.
The country of Western Links here, into the arms of Mary, George Jones. I mean, this is just getting better, though. It's going to have a country and Western sort of song list when we make the
You've
movie.
got the soundtrack, have you,
On the
Michael?
soundtrack, there'll be a few Irish ditties in there for sure.
So.
Was a Colleen with an independent air, and so on. But he's there. He's a very confident guy, this guy, Mr. King, isn't he?
He is indeed. So he says that he's a gold mining investor who's carrying a personal letter to Mr. Collins from a banking partner in Sydney. Now, Patrick Maloney, we
Must
know.
have thought something was going on if he'd already been confided in to some extent.
Well, Patrick Maloney was the ex-Dublin constable, so he wouldn't have been a pushover. And if he suspected that his new guest was no more a Jones than he was certainly not saying anything.
Well, I mean, it's a beautiful scene. King arrives in Frio for a long weekend or a bit longer. Breslin cum Collins is heading off down in Bunbury. We've got Mulaney at the Emerald Isle thing. This is all terribly interesting. What's happening here? Well, what else is going on in Bunbury?
Okay, so Bunbury at the time was quite a thriving port. The population of Bunbury at that time was pretty much the same as it was in Fremantle, about 2,000 people. And because of the convict labour that had been down there, they'd drained the swamps, created productive land there, built roads, constructed a jetty, and that allowed for a better trading port. Ships had always called in there, but it was really to get, water and provisions, but now they could export lumber and wool and various other things. So Breslin spent several days walking along the docks down there in the waterfront and staring out to the ocean, we're sure, looking for the American whaler and striking up conversations with a few captains. But then still no Catalpa on site. So on Saturday, the 11th of March, perilously low now on cash, he decided to leave Bunbury and he bought a ticket on the coastal vessel Mary.
Well, that's coincidental, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I take it was a much smaller vessel than the Georgette, which was, of course, the main one. But of course, he'd missed that by
Well, it mightn't have cost him so much to buy the ticket on the Mary.
So when he returned to the Emerald Isle, he was doubtful even that he could pay Maloney, the fees for the staying there, unless Clandegarl had wired him funds.
But he gets back to the Emerald Isle, and Maloney says, "Oh, we've had this fellow King called by the other day." Well, he must have. Well, he would have wondered what was happening with King.
You mean George Jones?
George Jones, I should say, but I'm on Maloney's side. He was as much a Jones as I am.
That's right. So shortly after Breslin's return, there's a knock on the door, and to his enormous relief, here stands John King, aka George Jones. And King handed over gold and £800 sterling.
My goodness, talk about winning the lottery.
I think so. So we can imagine the Breslin, who seems to have taken quite well to this wealthy lifestyle, would have just ordered another champagne and celebrated, I imagine, Michael.
And some Guinness and let Mary know that all was well.
Exactly. So the two men talked for a long time about the plans for the escape. And it must have been a relief for Breslin to actually have someone to talk to because it doesn't seem that he spent much time with Desmond, does it? We don't
Oh,
get those
doesn't
bits at
he
all.
had to
No.
pretend that he was still an artisan.
Yeah. So the Catalpa would wait. This was the plan. The Catalpa would wait in the waters outside of the territorial limit, and they'd send the whaleboat into the beach at Rockingham. And then Desmond and Breslin would be waiting with horse and trap here in Fremantle and at a rendezvous point just outside of Fremantle. And we know that that point was on what is now Hampton Road. And that the prisoners would slip away from their work and make their own way to the carriages. And Breslin felt confident that they were all military men. They had their wits about them and they'd figure out a way to do it and do whatever it took to get there. And as soon as they reached their rendezvous point, the two traps, Breslin and Desmond, would gallop away down to the Rockingham beach. And they climb into the whaleboat and row straight out to the Catalpa.
Dead easy, flat calm. What could go wrong?
Absolutely nothing. Not a thing could go wrong, could it?
So, what was King to do? Was he going to get on the boat and flee as well?
Well, King offered to remain here in Fremantle. Because at first, Breslin offered him money, some of the money to return, get a return trip back to Sydney, which is, of course, where King lived. But he said, no, I'll remain here in Fremantle as your business associate and I'll help you with the rescue. And then I will come with you on the Catalpa. So it was not a decision that was taken lightly by either of them.
Just going back in time a bit. I mean, I can't believe, to be honest, Margot, that the authorities is perhaps as dull or so far away from London or wherever they were. Couldn't have thought it was a bit strange that these guys were popping up. You know, here we are 150 years ago, and we did hear that Fauntleroy, or the governor of the day, had got some sort of word from the home country that there was some sort of rescue attempt being planned by somebody somewhere. I mean,
That's right. That's
just.
right. Remember, they had a communication from Lord Carnarvon in London, because it seems to me, Michael, the only thing that I can figure out is that, of course, the surveillance of the Irish in London and in Dublin was a lot more effective than it was here in the colony. I guess people might. There was Detective Sergeant Thomas Rowe from Scotland Yard, who came out here on the Hougoumont with the Fenians, and he had a role to play here. But in the meantime, Fauntleroy was going up, and he said they got some word of something going on, but Fauntleroy and Governor Robinson decided that it was better that they didn't scare the horses and that they would just keep this to themselves. But he went up, Fauntleroy, the superintendent of the prison, went up one night and said, so he was the controller general of the prison. He went up to the superintendent, Doonan, and said to him that he has to be very careful about how he locks the doors every night, because they believed that these operatives were going to come from London or Dublin and that they would try and bust people out of the jail.
Well, when I was a boarding scholar at a Perth school and we nicked out in the middle of the night and were caught, Margo, they did lock the doors afterwards, but they were trying to be ahead of the game here, locking the doors before they escaped. And so they were mighty ready in that sense. They didn't know where it was coming from or who it would be. What about Roe? I mean, what were his jobs? The Scotland
So,
Yard man.
Rowe was assigned to check on new arrivals into Western Australia, and he tailed two men to the Port Hotel. Now, that was a Fremantle lodging house that was a bit more down market than the Emerald Isle, but was a bit of a known hangout for the Irish. And it was in where the mall is now, close up to the town hall. And so Rowe had gone there and took down the names of two men who'd come in. One of them was Alfred Dixon and the other was Henry Hopkins.
Don't
Well, it
sound
was
very
not.
Irish.
They're a bit more imaginative than George Jones, aren't they? But he decided that neither man was suspicious. So
You
he
go.
clearly wasn't much of a Scotland Yard detective.
Why do you say that?
Because this Mr. Dixon was, in fact, Dennis Florence McCarthy, who was originally from Kenmare in County Kerry and later from Cork, and his accomplice, Hopkins, was John Walsh of Durham, England.
Well,
And
Durham,
both
England.
of these men were from
Yes.
the Irish Republican Brotherhood.
Wow, amazing. So they're IRB people. And what were they up to?
They were here to rescue the Fenians.
Oh, for goodness sake. We've got a surfeit of rescue missions. I hope they're not going to spoil ours.
Well, that's what we've got to come to now, Michael.
Well,
So it's
what happens?
so in the small settlement, you know, people noticed when new people were there, and Breslin was very suspicious of these two. He'd seen them strolling out of the Port Hotel, and he confided in King that he thought that they'd been sent out by the English government.
Ah, it goes both ways.
Yeah.
Got
So
English names. They must have had the Durham boy probably had more of an English accent.
he was Irish as well, but he'd lived some time in Durham. So, yeah. So Breslin also learnt from the prisoners that two men were expected. And this surprised Breslin. And of course, he then, when he put two and two together, he thought, well, of course, the prisoners haven't just been writing to Devoy.
They'd hedged their bets.
That's right. They've been writing to anyone and everyone who would listen to them. And your fellows at back in Ireland had collected money, found these two operatives, good men, sent them out here on a mission to rescue it. And we'll find out. So It was only then that Breslin realized how desperate these people were. So he was worried now that the British government knew about his plan and that they'd recruited these two Irishmen, they'd sent them out here to flush out Breslin and Desmond.
Couple of traitors, which the Brits have been pretty good at doing back in the
Well,
old
it'd have
home country, to find out who the mutineers were, who the Fenians were.
Well, that's how come the Fenians were in prison because
But
of.
he may have thought to himself, well, 50-50, perhaps 70-30, 60-40, perhaps they're here answering the call from inside the prison to get these Fenians out like we are. Maybe the king's men, and not that king, but the other one in London, and we need to find out, don't we?
That's right. So Breslin and King, and it was lucky that King was here, I think, because it gave Breslin someone to confide in and work out things. So King, they deliberated for hours on how they would find out the men's true identities.
I just go and
And
ask them.
well, it wasn't a pleasant prospect because they both looked pretty well dressed, and they actually thought that they looked like detectives or soldiers. So King came up with the final idea, which was to take a terrible risk. He said to Breslin that he was going to approach them and take them into his confidence as a fellow IRB man. So he was going to reveal that he was also an operative for the IRB.
This is nearly beyond foolhardy. If those guys were not the guys they turn out to be, but were carrying guns and sharp blades, and King mightn't be long for this life.
Exactly. It was an enormous risk.
What
But
happened?
the thing is that King said it's to Breslin, it's much better if I take this risk and they turn out to be informers, then I'll be arrested. I'll be thrown into the establishment myself. But you will be free to go about because I'll be the one who's thought to come in here to do it.
I mean, this really is laying down your life for your friend, isn't it? It's this is something to now King, as it transpires, survived all of this. Did he ever write about it?
He did. And so in his memoir, he recalled, he said, Fremantle was a small settlement, and nearly all the inhabitants being convicts or ticket of leave men, as they called it. There were very few free men, and all the ex-convicts remained under prison discipline. And when a curfew bell rang at 9:10, they were obliged to be in their houses for the night, which left the streets comparatively deserted from that hour.
So, doesn't that paint a picture? Something that I hadn't realised. Ticket of leave meant, like boys at boarding school, had to be in bed and were not allowed out. So, there's not many people around, except, Dixon, who the Irishman McCarthy, and his offsider from Durham. They can walk the streets if they like, as indeed can King.
That's right. So King walked the streets, found McCarthy, and he said to him, "What are you doing here?" And McCarthy was, a bit confronted by this, direct questioning. He said, "Well, I'm here to, he stumbled over his answer. I'm here to I'm going to on my uncle's sheep farm up at Champion Bay." But King just came straight to the point and he said, "I know why you're here. I know what you're doing."
Didn't know what the answer would be, though.
No. And of course, McCarthy, I mean, you can imagine this man's come all the way from Ireland to this end of the world, thinks he's in really good disguise, and a stranger in the street is telling him exactly what his plan is. It must have been incredibly confronting for him. So King said, "Listen here, McCarthy, I'm a sympathizer." He said, I am a sympathizer with your cause, and I'm in a position to give you material aid for your enterprise, but I need to be convinced that you are really who you say you are."
Well, but McCarthy must similarly thought these guys are just trying to trick me.
That's right. So McCarthy asked for half an hour to go and get his associate, the man from Durham, and he said he would meet him on the beach in half an hour's time.
Why didn't he go to Gino's and have a coffee and talk it up?
Michael, look, let's think about it. They didn't want to be seen. They didn't want to be overheard. They didn't.
Oh, good point.
We know that you can't keep anything secret at Gino's, don't we?
So they meet at the beach.
They meet at the beach. And of course, King went back, told Breslin what he was doing. Breslin was clearly worried, but of course he couldn't go. He's trying to keep up his facade of who he is, knows nothing about it. So he said to King, "You must trust your own judgment in this." So King goes down to the beach. He didn't know whether McCarthy was going to turn up with a load of police to arrest him, or maybe they'd just turn up with a knife and put it into him, because they wanted him out of the way. He knew too much. So he comes back, they come back onto the beach. King braced himself for what was coming, and the two men walked along towards him. And I always imagine this took place on Bathers Beach, down there in front of Cadogo. This
Absolutely.
thing.
We're all looking up at Arthur's Head, the roundhouse, thinking of all of the Irish, thinking about the future, beautiful moon coming up. The whole thing is very romantic.
It is indeed, except so McCarthy stopped close to King and he handed him a paper. And in fact, it contained the orders for McCarthy and Walsh from the IRB.
Oh my goodness. Now, wouldn't you like to have that in a museum in Fremantle?
Wouldn't it be wonderful? That paper must be just amazing. So King nodded. And after several minutes, McCarthy explained his rescue mission, that what he was here for was to smuggle the prisoners onto ships, and using funds from the satchel of cash that he had, that he was going to bust them out of Fremantle Prison. So King believed McCarthy was all right, and that was used as the IRB password. So then he takes McCarthy and Walsh up to the Emerald Isle Hotel, knocks on Breslin's door, and Breslin is a bit shocked to see not just King, but these other two operatives with him. So he introduces him to Breslin.
My goodness. And look, all of our listeners can just imagine that. They're not very far from Bathers Beach. You come past the roundhouse up High Street, probably only about 50 or 60 meters. You go in the front door of the Emerald Isle as it was, go up, knock on the door, and there's three men there, two of them, these others that up to that point, Breslin's just seen walking the street and was suspicious about them. Well, what do they talk about? What happened?
Okay, so then King recorded, and these are his words. He said, "There in the Emerald Isle Hotel, we talked matters over. When McCarthy found that we had all arrangements perfected, he volunteered the services of himself and Walsh. They also insisted on turning over to us a large sum of money, about $5,000."
My goodness. What did they take it?
They said, and then he said, "We declined their money but took their revolvers."
And then their money. This is just astonishing stuff. I don't know if they had a foreign exchange office. I guess it was all in British pounds at that point.
I think probably a lot of it was in pound sterling, yes, and also in gold. We know that a lot of King's money was in gold.
Well, Breslin stays in charge of all of this. He's still the
Of
main.
course, of course.
And so he's got two new recruits on his hands. What
Two
did.
new recruits and a couple of revolvers and a lot more money. So he's hot to trot. So he assigns the new recruits the key tasks of slicing the telegraph lines north and south of Fremantle on the day of the rescue. And that way, McCarthy and Walsh could buy time for Breslin, Desmond, and King to deliver the military Fenians to the Rockingham Beach. And it'd be hours before the message would get to the governor.
My goodness. So, oh goodness, we're in March. The 17th of March, as every good Irishman knows, including me through my mother's side, is St. Patrick's Day. I
It is indeed.
imagine there are a few little celebrations going on, letters being written back home by the Fenians and other Irish here to their families who are wondering what's become of them. Does Martin Hogan write anything?
Yes, he does. He writes a final letter home to his father. He says, "Dear Father, And this is the clue. Send nothing to me, no matter what kind it may be. Anything that my dear mother has left me, keep it until I get it in my own hands. Keep good heart, dear father. I will write a long letter next time. Your fond son, Martin J. Hogan.
Well, for goodness sake, if the letter had been seen by our Scotland Yard detective, you think he might have read something into that, Margot?
He seemed to sleep at the wheel too, didn't he? So Hogan's
Yes.
five comrades now are also, of course, praying that the American ship will soon be there to help them follow O'Reilly's path across the ocean. So every contingency now was provided for, all except
Except
one.
one. I mean, when are they going to do it?
So we're in the final week of March, 1876. Breslin fretting over the critical question, and on the 29th of March, he takes his usual walk to the telegraph office. And there on the board, Michael, was the news that he'd been waiting for.
Oh no!
The Catalpa has arrived in Bunbury.
Wow, imagine the celebrations. The four of them get together. Mary brings up the Guinness and the champagne. Oh, what happens next, Margot?
Well, we'll have to wait for the next episode, Michael.
Oh my goodness. I really, is there no way we can hurry this up? I guess we can't. I mean, oh gosh. All right. All right. Until next time, Margot.
Until next time, Michael, keep the faith.